Well, no late Norwich hour tonight, of course, because the fixtures are postponed. But joining us for a little chat for a late Norwich hour extra is none other than the voice of the Orient, Dave Victor. Good evening to you, Dave.
Good evening, Andy. How are you?
Not too bad, and it's very dark and uncertain times, isn't it, for everybody?
They certainly are, Andy. They're the sort of times when I think you start to appreciate things that you take for granted often. Not least the National Health Service. I mean, it's something that it's not perfect, and that's probably because it's not had the investment that it requires. But it's a service that's led by some incredibly dedicated people, and all we can do is sort of thank them. And as you say, these are very worrying and uncertain times, but there are also times when I think people come together and there's so many acts of kindness and people pulling together, and I think that's one of the positives we can take from what's happening at the moment.
Indeed it is, yeah. I mean, I think everybody, I think it's accepted we're all in the same boat on that front, and we all have to sit and hope, don't we, on the virus side of things. And obviously it's disrupted everything. It's disrupted, you know, your school as that you run during the day. It's disrupted my business, as it has everybody else's. But of course it's upset the football before all that happened. So quite disappointing for Ross Embleton, I should think, on a separate side of things, from the purely football side of things, Dave. He just seemed to be getting the club going, didn't he?
Yes, he has. I've got so much admiration for Ross, not just for the recent results and recent performances, but the way in which he's conducted himself throughout this season and before, really, in terms of what happened in the summer. I knew personally that I was never going to enjoy this season. It was always going to be for me something that would be overshadowed by the loss of Justin Edinburgh. It was very difficult as a result, I think, for me to have any enthusiasm, despite the fact that it was so wonderful to see Leighton Orient back in the Football League, because all our thoughts were always going to be about Justin. And of course, you know, his close personal friends and not least his family. And they have been amazing. The inspiration and the thing to take from this season has to be the Justin Edinburgh 3 Foundation. The leadership of Charlie and his family at such a time is absolutely incredible. And that will be the legacy. And in terms of Leighton Orient, I think you have to say well done to Ross, and far, far more than that. We have to say thank you to Ross, because he lost a friend. He lost somebody that he would have looked up to and would have been incredibly close to, and somebody that they achieved so much together. And one of the reasons why I think Justin is so difficult to follow is because he was not only a very successful manager, he was somebody that embraced people and somebody that had so much integrity. He was somebody that people admired, and Ross would have admired him, and he lost somebody very important to him personally. But he has been supporting other people. He's done that from the start. He's taken a lot of criticism. He's shown enormous courage. After what happened with Carl Fletcher, he came back again. It was tricky. The results were tricky. He needed new players, and we've seen the difference since the new players have come into the squad. You got the sense of a little bit of momentum, and now suddenly it's all ground to a halt. And like everything else at the moment, we're not sure what's happening next.
I mean, the appointment of Fletcher, in a way, Dave, I don't know how you feel about that, but I felt in a way it was a car crash of an appointment, but it snapped Orient out of a very understandable malaise, if you like. And I think it snapped him into gear once he departed. I think Ross was a different person thereafter, and I think the club was a different place thereafter.
Well, I remember we had a show, didn't we, after the Forest Green Rovers match, and I was sort of saying how I thought that Mark Cooper, the Forest Green manager, had done us all a favour, because we were so angry about what he had said to Ross and mentioning Justin's name. And I think what was helpful there was going to the ground. Everybody was talking about Carl Fletcher, and afterwards nobody was speaking about Carl Fletcher. You could see on paper why he was appointed, in terms of his background as a coach with AFC Bournemouth, and if there's a small club that you'd like to sort of follow, it would be in the path of AFC Bournemouth. It doesn't feel that long ago that we were playing them in the same division. But, you know, he was a strange fella. I don't know about you, Andy, but I found him somebody that was difficult to interview after the game. But since he's left the job, I watched him and listened to him on Talk Sport, and he was so fluent and he was so clear. And it was such a contrast to when I interviewed him. I never really got the impression that he took responsibility for the position that he found himself on. What was really impressive for Justin right from the start was that we lost at Solihull. He wouldn't have, I think he was appointed on the Wednesday, and we lost to Solihull on the Saturday. After the match, there was no doubt that he took absolute responsibility for that defeat. And he took ownership right from the get-go. With Carl, you never, ever got that impression. It felt as if it was happening at a distance and that he wasn't part of the results and the performances. But let's not talk too much about Carl Fletcher, because this season isn't about him. It is about Ross Hamilton. It is about the club. It is about the family. It is about the leadership that we've seen from the likes of Nigel and Kent, and they have been astonishing, as has Martin Ling. And I think it is a credit to this club that they took responsibility for the decision, and they haven't criticised Carl Fletcher.
No, they haven't. You've interviewed Ross, obviously, more probably than anybody else, and without sounding like we're patronising him, do you feel he's growing week on week into this role?
In a way. I've interviewed lots and lots of managers over the years, including every Laureate manager, obviously, since Frank Clark. I've never, ever known anybody as open as Ross. He's almost thinking out loud. So many managers are hiding things. When you speak to Ross, that isn't the case. He wears his heart on his sleeve. So from that point of view, that hasn't changed. He's also, I think, now found a system that he is working to. Lots of people were, particularly on social media, were going on about the formations. There was a logic to why people would be saying we need 4-4-2, but we need two very good central midfielders to play that sort of formation. And I think Ross has looked at the squad and looked at the players he's got available, and you can see the recruitment in January has made a huge difference. And I think it's enabled Ross to achieve the vision that he had right from the get-go, particularly after he followed Carl Fletcher.
Now, you've seen that the league are saying, shall they extend the season? Shall they finish the season? We know now that the lower steps are not going to be playing any further football. But it needs to be sorted out, doesn't it? Because they're players' contracts.
You'd have thought so. As I understand it, the season finishes sometime in mid-June, and I assume that's when most of the contracts finish. But to be honest, you need to talk to the likes of Danny Macklin and Martin Ling, because I have no idea, and there's no point really me speculating on all this. You can see the pros and cons. There's been lots of rumours about what's going to happen with the National League, for example. And you just wonder if it's possible for matches to take place when there are players that aren't well or testing positive. You know, there is a much, much bigger picture, much, much wider concerns at the moment than finishing the Football League. And I wouldn't want to be one of those people that has to make that decision. It's a dilemma. Whichever path they choose, there will be people that will be saying it's the wrong one.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing with football, and speaking now personally, is that, no, it's not important in the big shape of things, but it is important in the big shape of things, as it is a distraction. It's an entertainment form for people. It takes their mind off the seriousness and the terribleness of a situation as we're facing at the moment. So I suppose if there's any way you can get things happening even behind closed doors with fit squads, it may, you know, a lot of people may disagree, I don't know, it's just a personal point of view, but it would provide a welcome distraction for a lot of people, millions of people, away from obviously what is a very awful situation for all of us.
I agree, Andy. I think it's bigger than that. I think that at the moment, quite rightly, attention is on people's health and their physical fitness, but we've also got to think about people's sort of well-being and their state of mind. And Lake Norrington over the years, not least because of the bravery and courage of Martin Ling, we've probably been at the forefront of understanding mental illness and anxiety and such like. And again, there's so many things to be proud and grateful of in terms of our very special football club. And isn't it wonderful to see the lead that Lake Norrington have taken once football has been suspended? And you know, the work of Luke and Matt and the, sort of the leadership of Danny Macklin and Lake Norrington having that FIFA competition and seeing Lake Norrington take the lead on so many media platforms. And isn't it a Lake Norrington thing to do? You set up your own competition and you get knocked out at the right from the get-go. And that is so Lake Norrington. And there is a humour about the O's. And it is that humour at this point, Andy, that is so, so important.
And it's also good things. I mean, I read yesterday, I think Danny Macklin and Josh Wright got in touch with Eric Golding, who is, for supporters you might not know, there's a clip from 1974 against Manchester United when a fan comes out of the stand and runs the line. That's Eric. Eric was a vice president of the Vice President's Club. A lovely, lovely guy. Sadly suffered a series of strokes a couple of months back, and he's receiving end-of-life care at the moment. And the family got in touch, and Orient got in touch with Josh Wright and Danny, sending messages through, which at this time, with all the other things going on, it's yet another big tick to this club, I think.
It is, and you know, Danny Macklin has been on a lot of media at the moment, you know, local and national, and Lake Norrington, no doubt, reaching out to their fan base and to the community and being proactive. And again, it just makes you appreciate that we might not be the biggest club in London, but at times like this, we're one of the best, if not the very best.
Well, they've got the biggest heart, I think, Dave. I think that's for certain.
Yeah, that sums it up.
Let's just turn to you a bit, because I know people know about you doing the Orient commentary now and have done for, 30-odd years. But they, some of them know you are the head of a school in Stevenage, a special school for special needs. But you've been going with the commentary for a lot longer than just Leighton Orient, haven't you?
Well, yeah, I mean, in terms of reporting and covering games, I started doing that would have been very early 80s, if not the late 1970s. My first job was up in Ipswich. I mean, I was born in Upminster. My dad was from Forest Gate, just around the corner from the old Spotted Dog, and it would break his heart if he saw it as it is now. But, I went to my first Orient game with mates in 71, saw the O's beat Carlisle, and a few weeks later we returned and we beat Sunderland 5-0. One of those games that you just never, ever forget. And it was just such an amazing experience. I'd seen other teams and other games, but, you know, that was the one that stood out. And I think in 73, I travelled up with my dad to Turf Moor to see Lake Norrington beat a very, very good Burnley team. From memory, it was Burnley's only defeat. There's some astonishing players. It was a huge upset, but the best bit, Andy, the best bit was travelling back. I was a very young fellow at that point, and I can remember being in the buffet with Terry Brisley and Ray Goddard and others, the players, and, you know, one of them bought me a Coke, can't remember who, but, you know, thank you. And it was one of those things, you know, people talk about being close to players, but there is that connection at Lake Norrington, which is so important. My first teaching job was up in Ipswich. What happened, people might know that I worked with children with severe learning difficulties, and back in the 1970s, the children that I teach at the moment would have been deemed ineducable. There was an Education Act in the early 1970s. So I came into it at an interesting time in terms of I started as a nurse. Started working in what were then called subnormality hospitals. I did very badly at school. Yeah. I got a CSE in geography and an O level in woodwork. That was what I got when I left school to become a nurse of the mentally handicapped. I was told very early on that I had to be careful because these places were closing. There was a route into teaching, and at the time, because the schools were just opening, and they opened overnight, and you could become a teacher with very little in terms of qualifications. At the fifth time of asking, I passed my English O-level by a night school, and that was it. I was able to take the route, and it was a very, very strange route into education. So I have to admit, my career into the world of teaching was very unusual. Well, my first job was in Ipswich, and back in the day, do you remember when we were all snooker-loopy back in those times? And I was playing snooker at a very poor level, but, you know, enjoying it and playing it very, very regularly. And I was doing so with a fellow called Dave Hopps, who went on to work for The Guardian as their cricket correspondent, and he's still very much covering sport, as well as Neil Thomas, who was covering Colchester United at the time. And they invited me to do some work for the... Do you remember the old football papers you used to get on a Saturday before the internet? And, you know, you had to get the results in a town like Ipswich. You bought the Greenan. So I started writing a column in the Greenan and covering Harwich and Parkson. They were in the Ishbian League at the time. I actually ended up playing for Harwich and Parkson. I was never, ever a very, very good player. But this is a strange one, Andy. do you remember, you know, the Falkland War? Yeah. This is Harwich and Parkson. And they had a post-season tournament in Holland. And many of the players had to miss the trip because they were getting the ferries and converting the ferries to go over to the Falklands. So the tour carried on, and I was going over with Neil to cover the tour. And everybody was going on. My nickname then, people have always given me a nickname. It was Johnny Davis that called me Dulcet Dave. And back then, all the Harwich players were calling me Scoop. We ended up in Holland. I was meant to be covering the game, but I ended up playing. And it was a decent level. It was an amazing stadium. There was probably sort of 2,000 there. And I don't think I'm exaggerating. I was put on the wing and I was told to stay onside. And to be honest, Andy, I wasn't bad. We drew 2-all and I wasn't bad. The next morning I stood up and I couldn't walk. I couldn't move. And the manager said, "You're playing, Dave." I said, I can't. I'm so stiff." So I'm on the wing, and I can't move, Andy. I'm in so much agony. And we were playing a German team. And this fullback who was meant to be marking me, he could see that I couldn't move. And he asked me, "What am I doing?" And I explained to him, "I'm covering the game." And that's all I was doing, because I wasn't moving at all. So, and I don't know what these Dutch people were shouting at me, but many of them were, Andy. And that was how my career at a reasonable level ended.
Ah, and you went on to do Whips Cross Hospital Radio, didn't you?
I did, yes. This is back in the day... But there was an advert in Time Out asking for volunteers for hospital radio, and I put myself forward. And it was Carol Stokes that organised my first press pass. It was a very important one because, you know, I think it's the best view in the stadium. I'm a very lucky man, you know. It is a real passion of mine and yours, you know. You know what it's like, Andy.
Yeah.
I think it was a goldish draw about Wrexham, but the bit that I can always remember was sitting up in that press box, and it was so important. Back in those days, there were various sports agencies, and hospital radio had a relationship with the agency in order to get a telephone, because, you know, back in those days, there were no mobile phones, and there weren't many telephone lines in the press boxes. And I don't know why my name was mentioned, but one Thursday I got a phone call from this agency. I knew nothing about this agency, and I was asked if I'd cover West Ham against Sheffield Wednesday for Radio Hallam. I thought, well, I'll give it a go, and things became regular after that. Next thing I think, I was doing LBC quite regularly. Steve Tung was the football correspondent back in those days, I was unbelievably nervous, and I promise you, I really wasn't very good. But I learnt on the job, got lots and lots of work in terms of local radio. It wasn't often late night at that time. Things carried on, and was doing Capital Gold and such like. And I got a phone call again out of the blue saying, "We're setting up this telephone, premium rate telephone system. would you like to help us? Well, again, I think Don Allen probably was given, well, I know Don Allen was given the first option. He didn't want to do it. He was covering Yo's recorder at that point. So I stepped up and, you know, doing sort of reports and interviews down the telephone line. It's a young fella called Matt Porter that helped us as well. And
your big scoop, you know, Dave, I think, at that time, I mean, really, was the Peter Eustace incident, wasn't it?
Well, it was. I mean, there's a very good friend of mine, Chris Raistrick, who was one of the editors for the club line. Chris had a couple of scoops. The first one that you mentioned, Peter Eustace. Peter had a very, very dry sense of humour. And again, you just couldn't imagine this happening these days. So Chris phoned up, as he did, on a Thursday from home, Peter, just to get a little bit of team news and such like, and being club core, they'd sort of draw this out as long as they possibly could. So he phoned up Peter, and Peter sort of waited for the tape to roll, and then, you know, Chris would have said, so, you know, so-and-so on Saturday, what's the team news? And Peter said, well, you know, Chris, I can tell you that I met with the directors this morning and I'm no longer the manager of 8-9, so I can't tell you the team news. And then they carried on to look at his time at Brisbane Road. And then Chris phoned up, I think the first player he phoned up, and he was looking to get a reaction from the decision to lose his manager. So he phoned up Danny Carter, that he knew nothing about it. and then he phoned up a couple of other players, and by this time he got the tape running, and you heard Chris explain to the players that the manager has gone, and the first time they knew about it was from the fella from Club Call. Chris's other claim to fame, and I think a much bigger claim to fame, is he was doing an interview with Tony Wood. And, you know, Tony, again, was a very open man, an incredible gentleman, somebody who was so generous to our club.
He was, wonderful chairman.
To Tony Wood. Yeah. I think it's fair to say he'd have a drink every now and then, and I certainly interviewed Tony when he definitely had a drink, and he was very open at that time. And, you know, again, these were characters. It wasn't unusual in those days. Can't imagine it these days. But it really wasn't unusual back in those days to talk to a manager that clearly had a drink or two. I'm not talking about late night, but, it wasn't an unusual thing. And I think it was a throwaway remark. And he just said, well, Chris, to be honest, if someone gave me a fiver, they could have the club. And the next thing I know, I've got... I was doing work for... I think it was GLR back in the day, wasn't it? And the sports editor gave me a call and saying, what's happened about Orient? They're up for sale. And I think it was a throwaway remark. I don't think it was a decision. And I do what it started a chain of events that, of course, led to Barry Hearn, although he wasn't the only chairman. I think you've got a story to be told here about a piece. Yes. And you have got a very, very precious piece of paper with a...
I did have. I don't know what happened to it, but I wrote to him.
Explain that one, Andy? That's a good story as well.
Well, he wanted some commercial ideas for the club, and I said to him, it would help if you had a credit card machine for a start, because at the time it was cash only. And so I wrote down all the things that, you know, we would think would be good for the club commercially. And I said, well, for a start, you know, start taking debit card, credit cards, etc. And I wrote a list of things down. Anyway, he wrote back to me. And at the bottom of the letter, it's, you know, it just said, Philip Wallace, chairman, Leighton Orient Football Club. And, of course, he never was. He was doing due diligence for 30 days. But he wasn't really the chairman of the football club. And he wrote this letter to me, and I wish I'd kept it now, because, I mean, obviously, claiming he was the chairman, but he wanted the club to go to £250 a week maximum wage, and everybody part-time. And, of course, that would have been the death of the club. The one thing I would say, Dave, is that just before then, about five years before that, I ran a charity match there, and at the end of the season, and Frank Clark said to me, he said, well, the game's on Sunday afternoon. He said, well, I'll give you the keys. He said, let yourself in and, just give the keys to Carol at the end of the game. And Carol Stokes, the secretary, or the assistant secretary. And I went home with the keys to Leighton Orient, and I came along on Sunday morning about 10 o'clock and opened up the ground and went. I thought, can you imagine that happening now?
That's absolutely, and that season,
it's unthinkable.
It is unthinkable, but that season that finally led to Barry Hearn, I don't think people really realise just how close we came to losing Lake Nguyen. I mean, obviously, everybody knows about what happened under the previous regime, but in many ways, I think we were closer to the edge of the cliff then.
Yeah, we were. Dave, as we bring this to a close, what's your endearing memory, your more favourite moment at Lake Nguyen?
Wow. That's very hard. I'm not sure. There are so many standout ones. The first moment that comes to mind is being in the stand at Stamford Bridge and watching the O's beat Chelsea. With friends at the time. I was at college in West London, and we'd gone as a group, so I couldn't celebrate in the part of the round that I was in, but I felt so proud because I was the only Orient supporter in this group, and they'd gone expecting to see Chelsea win, and Peter Kitchen's goals were absolutely amazing. Promotion back into the Football League has to stand out there because, you know, it was what was achieved against the odds by such wonderful people. And it was so, so good to see the likes of Nigel and Kent and Justin and Martin and Danny and Matt Porter, who's worked so hard behind the scenes in Lake Nguyen's darkest days. And thank you to Matt and thank you to everybody to really turn things around so, so quickly. And we started this conversation by saying we mustn't take things for granted and we shouldn't. We shouldn't underestimate what was achieved not so long ago. And so much has happened since then. It feels further away than it actually was. But, the match against Braintree was a poor one. What happened afterwards was very, very special.
Yes,
and to see Joby McEnough, and I think we have to mention Joby McEnough because that man saw Lake Nguyen at our worst. You know, the way that he was treated, and I can remember talking to Ian Hendon, and Ian after one interview said to me, "Babe, why do you keep asking me about Joe?" I said, "Well, he's a big player, he's missing. You know, he's obviously couldn't claim, and he's obviously couldn't tell me he couldn't claim, and you couldn't understand the circumstances, and you couldn't. People were literally working with their hands tied behind their backs under appalling conditions, being treated very, very badly. And Joby was one of those. We know how badly he was treated. But it demonstrates the courage of the man. It demonstrates the character of the man. And I think that he knows that this is a special football club. And he played such a big part in the transformation of the O's. As Kent said, last season, we didn't have the best players, but we had the best team and we got the reward. And Lake Nguyen are back where they belong. And, you know, I had the privilege to be at Crewe, and I can remember that my voice broke when I said after 112 years, Lake Nguyen out to the Football League, and my voice broke, and I got into real trouble when I got home. I said, you know, two children didn't cry when they were born, or relegated, and you blab on air. Right? I'm not sure it's quite so. But I know what happened, Andy. I know what happened. As I said the words, I thought of my dad, and I thought about how my dad would have felt. And that's why my voice broke. And I think that's important because Lake Nguyen isn't about football. It's about, for me, it's about friends and it's about family.
Absolutely.
I mean, you have helped me and you've helped the school. And so has Nikki, your wife. And people come together. And at this time, that is so important. That is why Lake Nguyen is important. It's not about whether or not this season continues and such like. For me, it's about the leadership that Lake Nguyen have shown in caring for each other. We are a family club. Families fall out sometimes.
I think we've all made
families are important.
Countless friendships over the years with people there. Obviously, there might be one or two don't like him. Like Lord, certainly don't like me very much, maybe. Honestly, Dave, I'm very privileged to count you amongst my friends. And I do thank you for taking the time to speak to us this evening on this Orient Hour Extra. And I wish you and your family, along with everybody else, obviously, the best of luck under these circumstances. And hopefully we're all healthy and we're back at Lake Nguyen in the not too distant future.
I think that's all we can hang on to, is the fact that we will get through this. There is no doubt about that. There is an end point. We don't know when that will be. And it's about how we treat each other during this time. It's so easy to be anxious. It's so easy to be overwhelmed. But we can just take it by one act of kindness at a time. And all I can say to everybody is just stay safe and, you know, be kind to each other.
Thanks, Dave.